May it please the court, judges, my name is Scott Rosenblum. I represent the appellant here today, Nicholas Hillman, who has been convicted of attempt statutory sodomy and distribution of marijuana to a minor and sentenced to 9 years in the Missouri Department of Corrections. Keeping with some of the same themes apparently here this morning, I was not the trial counsel, nor, to be quite candid, we entered as the appellate counsel after the brief was filed. I do anticipate if we don't receive the relief here today, which we do believe we should be granted, that I will be the 2915 counsel and explore issues of ineffectiveness, understanding that nobody's entitled to a perfect trial. This young man received a trial that was far below the standards. Also keeping with the same themes, one of the issues I'm going to be talking about today is the issue of the transcript, and that this, Mr. Hillman, the appellant, did not receive a sufficient transcript to perfect his appeal, because the transcript in this matter suffered from many, many areas where it was indiscernible, incomplete, incoherent. Throughout the course of the transcript, and we cited in the brief, or it was cited in the brief, the many instances where that occurred. One of the most noteworthy instances was dealing with an offer of proof or an attempt offer of proof or some form of an offer of proof.
It doesn't seem like, from what we do have, that there was an offer of proof. There was talk about an offer of proof, and certainly that's something that could be established by stipulation, whether there was or wasn't, maybe not the substance of it. But
you know,
there doesn't seem to have been any attempt to do that here.
You know, I read that section in colloquy a number of times, and I still am not certain. And part of that is because of the indiscernible nature of the transcript. And some
but isn't that something, I mean, the record will show whether or not an offer was made. The court's notes, the prosecutor would have it. I mean, that's the kind of reason we require due diligence to be made.
Understanding reasonably required due diligence. And, you know, I thought about that a lot before I spoke here today. And I looked at the State versus Shin case. I think it's our duty to compile. As a practical matter, sometimes, especially when trial counsel has been relieved or there's my brief inquiries, the trial counsel is not necessarily cooperative with the family. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I don't really envision trial counsel and the judge sitting around at a Starbucks trying to create what happened. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's not a duty to create, it's a duty to compile, and this was compiled, and we're left with what we have some, whatever, 90, 120 days after the trial by way of the transcript. The transcript is deficient, and it leaves us in a situation where it makes effective appeal not very practical.
In the River Bend case, mm-hmm. I forget the exact number, but it was like 140 words that could not be distinguished, and yet we found that did not prejudice the party, that you could see, if you read it, you might not be able to reconstruct every word, but you could see it was not anything of significance that impacted the case. What's different here?
Well, just like in the Middleton case at the state sites, I think that when you're talking about some of the words that are being left out during jury selection where a person's talking, I mean, in that case, I think there was a veneer person talking about whether or not he may have known a lawyer or something. You know, I don't think that's particularly significant. In this case, there's entire bench conferences that have been left out as indiscernible. We don't know what was contained in those bench conferences. I'm assuming some of them may have had significant rulings, but the fact
is... But counsel was involved in those. I mean, why isn't there some obligation to say this bench conference is where I objected to introduction of evidence of the seizure of the property, and the court, you know, why is there something... If there's a question of did you preserve something and we don't have that record, then of course it's going to be relevant. But if there's not a question of preservation during that conference, why is it relevant? What happened in it?
I understand what the court's question is, but again, as a practical matter, sometimes trial counsel may not be cooperative. That was my understanding in this case. Again, we're relying on trial counsel that didn't feel it was necessary not only not to file a motion to suppress, but to object when inculpatory evidence was coming into the case, nor to raise it in a motion for new trial. To a certain extent, we're in a situation where this young man, Mr. Hillman, is being prejudiced by some of the lack of action on behalf of trial counsel. And to be candid, I'm not sure I would want to, as the second lawyer into the case, rely on this individual's recitation of the facts. I don't want to sound too harsh, but I think I need to sound harsh enough. In this instance, And what we're talking about, we're not talking about words that were slipping by in jury selection, or we're not talking about words that were slipping by when somebody's asking the name.
In River Bend, there were 9 bench conferences that had not been recorded, and counsel and opposing counsel did file a stipulation as to the nature of those conferences. So again, since it requires due diligence, even if trial counsel isn't cooperative, the alternative is to ask the trial court to, or the appellate court to intervene to obtain their cooperation.
Understanding that, but in this case, one of the bench conferences at issue resulted in the exclusion, which is the second point on appeal, of 10 witnesses that was determined to be a discovery sanction. 10 witnesses, and again, the record is somewhat sparse, but from what we can tell from the record, these witnesses were determined to go straight to the credibility of the complaining witness in this case.
Then isn't the basis for the trial court's ruling on that because the defense counsel was late in endorsing those witnesses?
Yes, it was. That was the basis of the ruling, but this case had sort of a history, an attenuated history, and in this particular case, there seemed to be a 30-day requirement to name all your witnesses and addresses back in February of 2012 with a gentleman by the name of Mr. Billings, who was first trial counsel, or maybe second trial counsel, I'm not sure. That was not done. At some point leading up to the case, Mr. Billings was relieved and trial counsel of record substituted. He did not then ask for an extension, granted. He did not follow the court's order to provide those individuals' names and addresses as he was required to do so. In fact, he then filed 17 endorsed witnesses 2 days before trial. Interestingly enough, there's reference in the record to a telephone conversation that apparently became heated that was not transcribed, but there's a reference to that in the record. And on that same day, interestingly enough, the state endorsed 2 witnesses that were permitted. So, you know, that seems to not necessarily be fair. And with respect to the witnesses that were ruled, and that's a drastic measure in any event. I mean, I've tried over 400 jury cases. I think I can stand before this court and say I've seen just about everything. And I have. And it's very rare where a court's going to exclude and gut a defense case based on a discovery sanction. You can make it incumbent upon the trial counsel to produce the witness and have the prosecutor interview that person. One of the things the courts always look at is surprise. Well, at least even in the state's own, in the attorney general's own brief, they talk about 6 of these witnesses were at least mentioned in the first round of endorsements. They just weren't mentioned by name, so they had some notice. And certainly, if you want to talk about fair play and gamesmanship, hey, send an email. Are you calling Joe Jones? And if you are, do I have an address? Or can I interview him? That happens all the time. It's not, you know, it's not the Cold War when you go through these cases. And with respect to 2 of the witnesses that were excluded, I mean, I find that particularly shocking because 2 of these individuals were mentioned in the police report, and one of which was mentioned in the victim's own, what they would call free write, and that was her boyfriend. So certainly I think it would be disingenuous for any prosecutor to say, well, these people are surprised. I mean, in fact, she probably would have had more access to these individuals than the defense. So it didn't seem that there was any real thought in excluding these individuals other than a discovery sanction, which then leads back to the transcript, because trying to make heads or tails
Would the trial court be guilty of abusing its discretion if it excluded a witness that would be, for lack of a better way of saying it, subject to the open file discovery provisions in criminal cases? In other words, if the prosecutor's general rule is, here's my whole file, you can come get it, and then the trial court excluded witnesses that if the prosecutor would have looked in his own file, he would have had it, would that be abuse of discretion?
I just want to make sure I'm understanding your hypothetical. So you're saying this would have been a state endorsement, that this would have been a state witness that wasn't endorsed, but the state basically opened his or her file.
Right. In addition to, here's my disclosures, you're welcome to come look at my file.
And you say in that case, the court...
Does that Is what happened here similar to that scenario?
Yeah, I would say it is similar. I would say that the lawyers involved have a duty to know the file. And I think it's, and look, I can't tell you how many times I've had a late endorsement and the prosecuting attorney said, well, it's in the discovery. And the judge looks at you and says, counsel, was it in the discovery? Yes. Well, what are you going to say? You don't read it?
And you're saying a number of these witnesses' names were in the prosecution's file, even if not formally endorsed?
Certainly two of them. Two of the 10 were in. One of the young men was mentioned in all the dissertations of the event. One was a friend that was actually there at the time, there for part of the evening where the events took place. And the other was part of the evidence that was produced by the state and entered into evidence, which was a free write, which was essentially the first report or the first allegation in the school context, and contained in that free write, she makes reference to her boyfriend, the complaining witness. And that became a significant piece of evidence in the case because that was essentially the first disclosure. There's also evidence throughout the course of the case as to when this first disclosure and who she told, whether the boyfriend had prior knowledge. So it sort of became a central issue in the case, and this person, to me, was arbitrarily excluded by this judge for a discovery sanction. Which, again, I'm still not clear on what, if any, offer of proof was made, because then we have the transcript problems. And that also baffles me, by the way, because, as I said, I mean, it's incumbent upon the lawyers, I think, to protect their record. It's incumbent upon the lawyers not to trample on each other's sentences, not to trample on the witnesses' words when they're on the stand. It's incumbent upon, to me, the court to protect the record. But it's certainly incumbent upon the court reporter that when she's up there and she can't understand anything, to throw up her hands. I mean, that's happened to all of us, I think, at one point. And I can't understand why you're going through an entire trial and there's swaths of testimony that's indiscernible. I mean, somebody's got to stop the proceedings and say, we got to get this stuff down. This is important stuff. It didn't happen, and it didn't happen to the prejudice of Mr. Hillman.
Do we know how this was taken down? Was it recorded and then transcribed later, or was there a live court reporter taking notes at the time?
I do not know.
Okay.
So that's why we're here today asking for you, the court, to reverse and remand this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. The defendant was not denied meaningful appellate review of his claims based on the omissions in the transcript. Defendant exercised no due diligence in attempting to correct these omissions. He didn't attempt to contact the prosecutor to get a stipulation that there was any kind of offer of proof. He didn't attempt to contact the trial counsel to set up some kind of stipulation regarding this. And he didn't make any kind of motion in the trial or in the appellate court to remand to the trial court to cure such omissions. He exercised no due diligence, and that should make his claim fail. On top of that, the defendant suffered no prejudice because the record itself, as we have it, it provided an adequate basis for appellate review. It's clear from the record that there was no offer of proof made. The record clearly, there are several indiscernible portions of the record when trial counsel attempted to make an offer of proof and then change. It's clear the trial court said, while the offer of proof won't change my decision in excluding these witnesses, I'm not going to stop you from making an offer of proof. And then no offer of proof was made. Because there was no offer of proof, there was no prejudice in the omissions in the transcript, because the lack of offer of proof means that the claim on appeal, his second point, the exclusion of the witnesses, would necessarily fail.
Do we know affirmatively there was no offer, since it is indiscernible at the end there of that conversation at the bench conference? It just trails off.
Actually, the end of the bench conference ends in the double dash, not a word indiscernible. Everywhere else in the transcript that there was an actually indiscernible portion, they use the word indiscernible.
What's the last sentence of it?
It does end in, it's a long sentence. Was I wrong in saying that you couldn't have a late endorsement? Then that's the case. Then when you guys come back, your offer of proof isn't going to choose the Court of Appeals of any knowledge of that issue because the issues that they gave irrelevant testimony or they indiscernible, but again going and then it has dash dash instead of indiscernible and just based
and,
on.
And you're saying that we should assume from that that the conference ended in the middle of a sentence?
From the record that we have, I do believe that that's what you should assume.
Were there any indiscernible portions that occurred other than that sidebar?
Yes, there were, I think, a total of 31 indiscernible portions throughout the second volume of the transcript. But because only the omissions related to that sidebar are relevant to any issue on appeal, none of the other omissions resulted in prejudice to the defendant.
If they had done an offer of proof, they would have gone back and done that with a witness at the witness stand, yes? Either then or when the jury was next out of the room, right?
I believe so, yes.
Or they could have summarized, whether we would find it sufficient right. or not, they might have summarized what the witnesses would say.
Right, they could have. And even just a basic attempt to get a stipulation that there was an offer of proof made would have clarified this issue for appeal, and it was not done. So the defendant failed to meet his burden of exercising due diligence, and so his claim should
fail. Does the court, I'm not suggesting we would do this, but does the court oppose remand for that purpose now?
In light of the fact that it's clear that his second point would fail anyway, then remand would be unnecessary. Because the exclusion of the witnesses was not an abuse of the trial court's discretion.
Did the trial court exclude witnesses that were otherwise available in the discovery?
That were otherwise available in
Your
the discovery?
Opposing counsel suggests that there were at least two witnesses that if you would have looked at the file would have been obvious that they were potential witnesses to both sides of the case.
I would say that these two witnesses that opposing counsel talks about in the actual police reports, mm-hmm. they're described as AJ and Joe. And there's no other information in the police report as to who these people are.
So you're saying the prosecutor didn't know who the victim's boyfriend was?
It's not clear from the record that the prosecutor would have known. If they would have known, that's
mentioned
still
in the victim's statement.
Certainly. She just called her boyfriend AJ, though, and the person they endorsed was I can't remember his full name. It's Anthony something Jr. And something wasn't, it's not a J. So it wouldn't necessarily be readily apparent that this Anthony person was AJ. I don't know if the prosecutor
I think,
knew.
Maybe I was the question though, was it readily apparent that there was a boyfriend named in the file who she said she talked about the incident to?
That would have been readily apparent. But the fact that the state knew of the existence of these people doesn't necessarily mean that the state would have, it doesn't negate the unfair surprise in the fact that the defendant was going to call them as a witness and told them that they would call them as a witness only 2 days before trial.
Can you explain why the court allowed the state to endorse two late witnesses but not the defense?
I cannot. I know that one of the witnesses that they endorsed at that time was a police officer who was named in the police report. And the other one was someone who was actually endorsed on the defendant's first initial faulty endorsement, the one without any addresses.
The court didn't explain why it ruled as it did, though?
Not that I found in the record. So it's not clear to me at that point.
But for a police officer, an investigator surveying this the crime, you don't have to be Kojak to figure out Anthony J could be AJ.
That's true. But the state, in order to prepare for the trial, is not required to interview every single person that it knows of in existence related.
But they're available. The statement is taken by the police. They know these people are available and who they are. They're somehow connected, conceivably, and they can investigate themselves.
Well, they wouldn't have necessarily known that they were available per se, since it wasn't. The police report didn't contain anyone talking to AJ. It just contained the victim's statement that had the name AJ mentioned in it. While the state doesn't, to prepare for trial and to not be unfairly surprised, the state's not obligated to interview every single person that they know of that's related to the case. This, the fact that these names could have been the names that were in the police file doesn't ameliorate the unfair surprise that the state faced 2 days before trial when they suddenly realized, oh, there are going to be 10 more witnesses that I didn't know were going to be called. I have to track them down and depose them, or at least find out generally what they'll say. On top of that, the defendant offered no reasonable justification for his late disclosure of these witnesses, and cases have held that when there's no reasonable justification for the late disclosure, then exclusion of the witnesses is justified. Additionally, the defendant suffered no fundamental unfairness in his trial due to the exclusion of these witnesses. While the witnesses, it's, from the record that we have, it's clear that the trial counsel did not make an offer of proof regarding what these witnesses would have said. Based on the lack of the offer of proof, we don't know if any of these witnesses' testimony would have materially altered the outcome of the case. If we go simply based on what the defendant asserts in his appellate brief, was that the witnesses would have called into question the veracity of the victim. Well, cases have held that that the exclusion of a witness will not result in fundamental unfairness when that witness's sole purpose was to impeach another witness and when the subject of the impeachment actually testified and was subject to cross-examination. Here, that other witness who is the subject of the impeachment was the victim.
But without hearing the witness, we're just guessing.
Right, but that is, I'm just going based on what the defendant guessed. Certainly. And if that is the case, then the defendant suffered no fundamental unfairness from the exclusion of these witnesses. Because the defendant suffered no fundamental unfairness, his point should be denied. If there are no further questions.
Can you address the remaining points? You said that they were without merit and therefore this doesn't matter.
Oh, I was saying that the only point that the omissions related to was point two, the exclusion of the witnesses. The omissions in the transcript don't affect the suppression of the evidence or the constitutional issue he brought on appeal. Okay. But I'd be happy to address them if you'd.
No, I would just thank you for clarifying that.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Rosenblum.
Just briefly, in response to the court's questions about how the court determined to allow the state its two late endorsements, I found it a little amusing that the response was, well, it was in the discovery. One was in the discovery and one was in the previous endorsements that left that were determined not to be useful because they didn't have names. Reading from the respondent's own brief, talking about that. Furthermore, 6 of the 10 excluded witnesses were named in counsel Billings' initial endorsement of 34 witnesses. So defendant's suggestion that he did not know these witnesses prior to 2 days before trial is refuted by the record. And then additionally, 2 of the remaining 4 witnesses were named in victim's account and in the police reports, of which defendant had in his possession since May 4th, 2011. I think that that would be sufficient to not only suffice for the analysis for the state, but also the analysis for the defendant's endorsements. And certainly, I think it would be disingenuous to suggest that at some point the state can't ask its complaining witness, who's AJ, and is that your boyfriend? That's rather disingenuous. As far as this offer of proof being clear, to me it's clear as mud. If you really read it, which I have several times, there's a colloquy between the court and the trial lawyer about whether or not there's a need for the offer of proof. And then the prosecutor chimes in at some point and says, well, we're not really dealing with relevancy issues because the court's already said, I'm not saying it's relevant or not relevant. What I'm saying is this is a discovery sanction. So we're not even going to get to the relevancy issue. But if you want to make an offer of proof, go ahead and make it. And then at some point, as they go on, the prosecutor speaks up and says, well, here's what your issue on appeal is going to be. Your issue on appeal would be that the court erred in not allowing you to put on these witnesses because of the endorsement, not because there was a ruling of inadmissible testimony. The court goes on to say, was I wrong in saying that you couldn't have a late endorsement? Then that's the case. Then when you guys come back, your offer of proof isn't going to choose, sick, the court of appeals of any knowledge of that issue, because the issues that gave irrelevant testimony, or they indiscernible, we don't know how many words, but again, going, and it just goes off into space.
When I read that portion of the transcript, I thought the trial court was saying, I don't care what they have to say. It doesn't matter. I'm not changing my mind. Is that a fair reading of that?
You know, I think that would probably be a fair reading, but I think also a fair reading when, especially dealing with what I can only surmise is a rather inexperienced trial counsel, is it's although saying I'll let you do your offer of proof on one hand, he's certainly from the bench sort of suggesting, well, why bother? And I'm not saying he shouldn't have forged on if he didn't actually do the offer of proof, which I still don't know because there's so many indiscernibles and words that have tailed off. I don't think we can know for sure. And at the end of the day, we're left to speculate and we're left with innuendo. And I think that innuendo and speculation works on unfair prejudice on Mr. Hillman, the appellant here today.
But the cases are clear. It's trial counsel's responsibility to make an offer of proof because the fact that he may have relied on the trial court to decide not to when he's wanting to make it because he thinks the trial court's wrong, that isn't really an excuse for not making the offer.
True, but there is some limited areas where it can be preserved without an offer of proof. There's that narrow area. And again, though, we can't, I guess at the end of the day, we just can't be certain of what was said in that colloquy.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advice.